Good morning. This meeting of the House Education Committee will come to order. Today is Wednesday, April 5th, and the time is 8:03 a.m. Members of House Education present are Vice Chair Representative Justin Parrish, Representative Dave Tallarico, Representative Chuck Kopp, Representative Jennifer Johnston, and Representative Zach Fansler, and myself, Representative Harriet Drummond. We have a quorum to conduct business. Before we begin, I'd like everyone to silence their cell phones. And today our recording secretary is Kelly Burnett. And Alex Bibi Guidice is our LIO moderator, assisting with teleconferencing and technical support. Thank you both. Today, we will have Doug Walrath, the Executive Director for the Northwestern Alaska Career and Technical Center. NACTEC was developed by the Bering Strait School District and Nome Public Schools as a joint venture regional vocational training center to provide high school students with the necessary skills for employment opportunities. We have only scratched the surface on the importance of vocational education this session, so I'm very excited to hear more from Mr. Walrath. But before we get to that presentation, we are going to take up House Bill 189, School Bus Inspection Fees. There have been several pieces of legislation introduced in the last few weeks dealing with pupil transportation, and I know this is one of the areas the legislature wants to start looking at. So with that said, would the bill sponsor please come forward and put herself on the record and proceed with her presentation. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Tammy Wilson. I'm State Representative for District 3 North Pole. HB 189 allows the Department of Education to establish by regulation a fee to cover the cost of the school bus inspections required under AS 14.09.030B2. The school bus operators will be charged this fee. Thank you, Madam Chair.
That's a tough one.
That's all it does, Madam Chair.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Johnston.
This doesn't have anything about how many inspections, right? It's just the fee itself.
Through the Chair, Representative Johnston, that's already in statute. It is twice a year. We do the state does the inspection, and we also currently pay for it. This would make the school bus operators pay for the. It would not change the inspections whatsoever.
Thank you. And well, a follow up.
Go ahead, Representative Johnston.
So by charging this fee, my concern is I'm not sure if it's the state's responsibility for the inspections. Would you ever consider it being a local responsibility?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, this bill is now your committee bill, and whatever you'd like to do with it, you may. I think what we just want to make sure with this bill, you know, for the budget process, as I went line by line, I found this would be one of those. I had an amendment, found out that I could not take it out because by statute it did not allow the department to be able to charge the fee. But absolutely, if it's better for the school districts themselves to be able to do that, I am fine with that.
Thank you.
Representative Fansler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, how much does one of these cost?
Representative Fansler, through the chair, it doesn't really detail out in the statute how much each one costs. The fiscal note basically is just dividing the amount of school buses they have in the semi-annual, and through regulation they'll make that determination. Because now they'll be able to do that, they could change that, they can make a specific amount, or they can use the $210,000 that they currently have in the budget as the baseline.
Follow up.
Go ahead, Representative Fansler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, is this the fee just being paid to the inspector, or I'm, you know, a little unclear as to what happens during an inspection for a school bus? So,
President Fansler, to the chair, currently the state conducts the inspection and the state pays for the inspection. And what this bill does is allows that to be charged back to the private vendor, just as if your truck has to be inspected, which we require that of the state, but the state doesn't pay for all the inspections required underneath that. So I'm just trying to make things equal, since these are private contracts, that I'm fine with the inspection. In fact, we want to make sure that our school buses are safe, but I could not really figure out why the state started paying for it.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is an effort to shift costs from the state to the school bus operators. And like Representative Fensler, I'm curious just how much a school bus inspection costs.
Representative Parrish, through the chair, it's not just shift a cost, it's their responsibility. I don't know why the state was decided to start doing it. We don't do it for any other industry. We require a lot of safety inspections in a lot of businesses, and that business pays for it. If you would look at the fiscal note for HB 189, page 2 of 2, it says the number of buses inspected each year varies, but on average there are 1,055 buses that are inspected each year. The department would establish a school bus inspection fee at $175 per bus per inspection.
Well, there's no provision for, by regulation. So by regulation, they could change the fee, I suppose.
Parrish, absolutely.
My concern is that ultimately the safety of our students is the responsibility of the state. Buck stops here, so to speak. I wouldn't want there to be ever a situation where a school bus operator, in order to minimize costs, I think ultimately it's our responsibility, and I don't feel terribly comfortable trying to escape the responsibility by any means.
Representative Parrish, to the chair, absolutely we're not going to do that. The inspections are still required. The inspections will be done exactly as they are right now. The difference is who pays the fee. So as far as how the inspection is done, who does the inspection, that does not change with this bill. All this bill does is say that the department can charge to the private companies the cost of having the buses inspected. So we're not putting the inspection itself on how they conduct it with anyone but the state. So the state is staying with the responsibility of how they currently do it. It will still be semi-annual. The only thing this bill does has to do with cost. And who pays?
Representative Parrish, we have a bunch of other questions. Are you done with your line of questioning?
I just like the fiscal note. I don't see it in my packet here.
I'm not finding it on basis either, so
it wouldn't be a fiscal note.
At some point.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, I saw a bunch of hands go up over there. I want to say Representative Fansler was first, then Representative Kopp.
I was going to swallow the poison pill and admit that I didn't have the fiscal note, but it seems like I am in
not your
the
fault.
Entire
I believe they're copying it right now, Representative Fansler.
Right, Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess as to the fiscal note, it would probably be zero because the expense would be part of the contract. But my question for you, Representative Wilson, is one way or another, this $147,000, we're going to be paying for that one way or another. Is that right? Because if we allow the department to establish a fee and the contractors go ahead and pick that up, they pay for their own bus inspections. We negotiate contracts every year, so they're going to figure out that as a cost. So one way or another, the state is paying this, but you could argue that if they are paying it out of their contract costs, they may own that inspection more carefully because now it's actually part of their budgeted amount that they receive from the state for busing kids. I just want to make sure I understand, because I know this fee is one way or another we're paying it. Either we pay it directly, or I'm paying it to you as a contractor through what we negotiate, because you know what your costs are. So when we decide you're going to bus kids for me, first student or whatever, it gets paid regardless. It's just whether you're paying it or whether out of the money I give you or whether I'm paying it directly. Do I understand that correctly?
Richard Cuff through the chair. Absolutely, but I think also, as Representative Johnston just said, some of the local school districts may decide that they prefer to be the ones that are conducting it. They may have a better way of being able to do it, might be able to do it more affordable. I don't know why they decide to start with, you know, twice a year versus, you know, once a year. But it starts that kind of conversation. When someone else is paying the bill, a lot of times we don't take the same look at what's happening than if the cost is shifted to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Johnson.
A follow-up to that, and sort of a follow-up to Representative Parrish's questioning, who is ultimately liable for the school buses?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, I'm not an attorney, nor do I play one on TV.
Really?
I would say it would be the responsibility of those who have the contract on whether or not those buses are safe. I would assume that most likely maybe the statute came because at the beginning, maybe we were getting buses that weren't safe for children. The state decided they needed to step in and make sure, because we just don't, nobody wants a child to be hurt. So instead of worrying about who had the liability, the state just wanted to make sure everyone was safe. Therefore, the inspection came. And with that came the cost. And unlike most of our statutes that allows the departments to then charge fees, on this particular one, that was not put in when the inspections were. And so, therefore, even if the department right now would want to charge a fee, they cannot without this legislation.
Right. I just, you know, as a follow-up, I think probably if it's a private contractor, of course, they have to be bonded, so they're liable, but they're also in partnership probably with the local school district, and probably if that's within a borough or a municipality, that's your line of liability, and that's your line of responsibility. So I think this is an interesting discussion on how and who's, where does the buck actually stop? Thank you.
I have a couple of questions myself. Representative Wilson, do you know who inspects buses now? Is it the Department of Education or Transportation?
It's my understanding, Madam Chair, that it is the department.
Okay. And can the department speak to this bill? Is anyone here that can?
It was my understanding they were going to be here today.
There, I see.
They are here.
Okay, great. Let's have them come forward and tell us what they think about the bill.
Works for me.
And I'd like to note that Representative Sponholz has joined us at about. I think it was 7 or 8 minutes after 8. Good morning. Go ahead and put yourself on the record and talk to us about this bill.
Good morning. Heidi Tushner, Director of Administrative Services with the Department of Education.
And I am Elwin Blackwell, with School Finance Manager with the Department of Education.
All right. So how do you know what impact this might have on future school bus contracts? And does the department now conduct the inspections?
Madam Chair, right now the department contracts with Resurrection Auto to do inspections twice a year. And the way the bill reads, it is this cost would go, because it states that it would be charged to the school bus operator, and currently there's district-operated school buses and contractor-operated school buses. So the cost of this would go both to school districts and to contractors. So there would be an impact to districts that don't pay for a contractor. Does that make
sense? An example of a district that doesn't pay for a contract?
So right now, an example of a district-operated, Anchorage School District is a district-operated versus a contractor-operated.
Right, partially. Right, I think Anchorage is about a third district buses and about two-thirds contractor buses.
Correct, the district.
Put yourself on the record.
My name is Owen Blackwell.
Thank you.
And to the chair. Yes, Anchorage operates some of their buses as district-operated, and then they operate some of the buses through a contract with, I believe the company is Reliant, is the name of the contractor. Yeah, Anchorage owns about 122 buses, or somewhere in that neighborhood, and then Reliant runs about 180, 181 buses, so it's a little less than half.
Okay, and does the Anchorage School District pay to, the department currently contracts to inspect both Reliance buses and the Anchorage School District's buses?
That is correct.
I'll let Representative Sponholz ask her question.
Well, actually, I don't know that I specifically have a question for you, but I did want to clarify for the record. I mean, we all have the fiscal note now, and I've been reading the fiscal note, and to clarify, the costs are being paid for by the state right now, and in the under this bill, there would be cost shifting, and the cost shifting would either go to the districts or it would go to the contractors. And it looks like we've got about 95,000 in 2019. I'm still waking up. 97 the following year, and then 137. So I just want to be clear that according to the fiscal note, this is a cost shifting, a moving of costs from the state to either local government and or contractors, and that the state of Alaska will be collecting fees in order to implement this program. That's a little bit different than what we were talking about earlier, and now that we all have the fiscal note, I want to make sure that that was on the record.
Representative Johnston.
I have two questions. One is, do you have the data from these inspections as far as have you found a number of school districts or contractors that have had violations as far as the safety inspections? And that's my first question. I imagine you can't get that to me right now, but I would like to know what data you have on it. And secondly, with your contractor, so is this contractor a certified school bus inspector? Is that how you?
Elwin Blackwell, through the chair, yeah, Representative Johnston. The contractor that the state has hired to do school bus inspections has gone through a process of becoming a school bus inspector. We entered into this contract. We've had the same contractor for now. It's been quite a few years, and I don't remember exactly all that they went through back 10 or 15 years ago when they started doing school bus inspections for us, but they did go through some additional training to be able to do the school bus inspections, and there's a whole series of criteria that they have to check for when they're doing the inspections.
So I guess my question to you and to anybody is, how involved is that certification, and if this were brought back to a local level, is it something that a local garage mechanic could get, so it could be done locally as opposed to having, because I'm sure part of this contract is getting in and out of villages, I imagine travel is a huge part of this contract. And so if it was something that was able to be brought back locally and to a local responsibility, I'd be interested of really what the cost shifting might be as opposed to what we're doing now. And I understand you can't get me that information right now, but if you could, that would be greatly appreciated.
Yeah, through the chair, we can see what we can potentially provide you.
All right. Any further questions? Representative Parrish, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The bill, as I understand it now, doesn't provide for any change in the person who's actually doing the inspection. Is that your understanding as well?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, yes, that is our understanding.
Thank you.
Let's see. Okay, I'm actually interested in how many buses are found in our school districts.
215 district operated. And then it looks like 200.
Oh, I see. Okay. The fiscal note does have 1,055 buses.
That is correct.
Inspected each year. All right. My intent is to set this bill aside for now. If there are additional questions and responses from the department, that would be good. And actually, I have another question for the bill sponsor. So thank you, department representatives. Thank you, Representative Wilson. How do you feel about the number of inspections currently provided per year? There's a bill on the other house that is proposes to change that from two inspections a year to one inspection a year.
Representative Wilson, for the record, Madam Chair, I don't have a problem with doing that. I think the reason I brought this forward was not just, you know, who pays for it, but Representative Johnston brought up a good point. The Fairbanks North Star Borough, as well as Anchorage and a few others, we have a whole busing system, public busing system, and they don't go through this inspection, but yet I haven't heard any safety issues with them. I do believe if you bring it back to local control, there's inspections already going on. If that was one of those that could be handled, I think a lot of those buses would get more than twice a year, because I think everybody wants to make sure that buses are safe, whether or not we're talking about our school buses or our public transportation. If we could get some data from the department as far as how many violations there have been, because again, the inspection is something that we require. The liability is something that the school districts, the boroughs, and the bus operator are already under. So if something were to happen and they were found to be liable because they had something unsafe, it's to their best interest whether or not we would even require this to be done to make sure the buses are safe. So, you know, I am not tied to once or twice. I just would prefer, you know, this is another thing I'm not sure the government needs to be involved in anymore. And, you know, is it going to cost more for other districts? Because, again, transportation is a huge issue and may even be an impediment for being able to use possibly vans instead of buses in other areas that they just can't get them there because they're not on the road system.
I know that some districts are having trouble getting even bus drivers trained right now. Did you mention potential cooperation with public transit systems as opposed to school bus systems? Or, for example, I know Anchorage is already collaborating with its People Mover system, but there's a significantly fewer number of buses in the People Mover system, so I'm not quite sure how the district would save money because they have significantly more buses than the transit system does, at least in Anchorage.
Well, Madam Chair, they already have a system, though, and they don't have to hire somebody just sitting and waiting for a bus to be there. They may have to hire someone, but that may be much cheaper than what we're talking about here, which is a per bus charge of a fee of $175 per bus per time that they do that. That's $350 a year. So having that system already aligned in those areas, because they already have a system, they already have, I can talk about our borough, they already have a garage that they can move those in. They have inspectors who are certified to make sure, because again, you know, all this comes back down to liability. No one wants to do anything unsafe, even if they didn't have a liability. That's why at this point I wasn't changing necessarily the inspections, but I do think that's another conversation that needs to happen, because again, we already have that set up. Why are we duplicating and costing more to the state to do it? So if local municipalities can do it, or we can work with some of the villages so that it opens it up to where if they're able to get transportation, whether that's in the form of a school bus, maybe a van, we want to make sure that our children can get to school in the safest way possible.
All right. Seeing no further questions, thank you very much, Representative Wilson. I'm going to set this bill aside, and we'll look at any responses that come in. Mr. Walrath, welcome.
Thank you.
All right. It looks like our presentation is ready to go.
Okay.
Sir, put yourself on the record and proceed with your presentation.
For the record, Doug Walrath, Director, Northwestern Alaska Career and Technical Center in Nome. I served in that capacity for the past 8 years. So, Madam Chair and members of the Education Committee, I
sincerely thank you for the opportunity to come down here from Nome and present to you today what we believe to be a very innovative and collaborative approach to delivering career and technical education in the Nome census area. So my presentation here, I'm going to provide a little historical overview of NACTEC, the Northwestern Alaska Career and Technical Center, get into programming. Student programming is really the heart of what we do, and with some data and student success stories and a few recommendations. I'm certainly comfortable taking questions as they arise along the way. In the packet before you, the presentation is in the left-hand mm-hmm. folder, and then there's supporting documents that I'll reference as well within there. So a little overview of the history of NACTEC. NACTEC is the Nome Census Area Regional Training Center. 2003-04 was our startup year, so we've been delivering training for 14 years. We delivered 30-plus vocational training programs, and I'll note vocational training used somewhat synonymously with career and technical education. A lot of folks in our region still prefer, I think, the term vocational education. They relate to it well. It is a partnership between Bering Strait School District and Nome Public Schools. So Bering Strait School District is an REAA surrounding Nome, a city school district. It's a partnership that came together effectively to address the need of high dropout rates as was occurring. There was little for vocational education that was offered with continuity across the 15 villages of the Bering Strait School District. And in Nome, the Nome Belts High School was originally built as a William Belts vocational boarding school in 1966. So there's three large shops that were there through the years. Those three shops were down to effectively one teacher teaching in them. One of the shops had become mothballed, was used for nothing more than storage. So the two school districts collaborated, and there were mutual needs that a third entity, Regional Learning Center was the term at the time, that could arise, could serve the needs of both districts better by both districts collaborating together and providing resources to make what became NACTEC emerge. So we are a variable term residential program, meaning we offer programs between 1 and 4 weeks in length. Our programming tends to start up in August with a one-week field biology camp up at Salmon Lake that we partner with UAF Northwest Campus to deliver, and ends around mid-June. So July is currently the only month we're not delivering training. And we had a 26-bed student dormitory that was built new in 2008, so now in our ninth year of using that facility. So where are we located? If you look at the map, Nome is the regional hub, so located on the southern end of the Seward Peninsula. So we're up in the Bering Strait, Seward Peninsula, Norton Sound region. Reaching students as far north as Shishmaref on the Chukchi Sea, to the west out in Little Diomede, and on St. Lawrence Island, Gamble and Savunga. Our southern boundary would be Stebbins and St. Michael on the southern edge of Norton Sound, and to as far east as Uniclete and Shaktulik. Where have our students come from? Primarily, our students come from Bering Strait School District and Nome Public Schools. Over 90% of the students come from there. However, we have developed and we've maintained partnerships with other districts as well. So we have served students from over 50 villages. I believe 55 is the current count. One of the ongoing, long-sustaining partnerships we have is with the Voyage to Excellence program of Chugach School District. It's an exchange that we've developed because we have vocational training facilities that we can serve their students that they're without, and they have access to urban living skills and transition skills that frankly we don't have in Nome. So just this week, right now, we have a transitions program occurring at Avtec as our staff flew through Anchorage yesterday. We picked up one of our partner students from the Voyage to Excellence to bring along in our program. The 2 weeks prior to that, we had four students from Koyuk, Brevig Mission, and Gamble that joined one of the Voyage to Excellence outdoor leadership programs. So that two-way exchange allows us collectively to provide a wider menu of opportunities than either one of our programs could deliver on their own. And I think is something that's very innovative, and it provides opportunities for lots of students to get served if we can just develop the partnerships to make those things happen. This is a look at our organization chart. We're a small organization. There's 8 full-time employees, as you see. And we have a governing board comprised of the superintendent and a school board member from Bering Strait School District in Nome Public Schools, as well as the director of UAF Northwest Campus that meets quarterly. We have an advisory board that meets annually. It's a representative of each of the 15 villages, folks from within Nome, the school districts, the university, the job center, the Chamber of Commerce, Norton Sound Economic Development Corporation, the Native Corporations. We have many voices that are at the table, and soliciting input assures that the program that we offer meets the regional needs. So it's myself, a program coordinator that oversees a business and marketing, industrial technology, family consumer science teacher, and a counselor, a classified driver's ed instructor, adjunct faculty come on from Norton Sound Health Corp, UAF Northwest Campus, to deliver a wide array of courses that we don't have the technical expertise on staff. And then we have part-time, casual-time employees, our house parents, our classified staff, so that we're providing 24/7 supervision of students in the residential setting. Mission statement, NACTEC will prepare students for the world of work by assisting in the development of life skills, work readiness skills, academic skills, and career awareness, while maintaining the academic standards of Nome Public Schools, Bering Strait School District, and affiliate partners in an atmosphere that respects diversity and individual identity. What's highlighted in bold there is kind of the elements that we hang our hat on, our life skills, our work readiness skills, academic skills supported through career and technical education instruction, and career awareness. We really look to get students started career awareness, into career exploration, and then as we progress through high school, into career immersion training, ready to transition them into the world of work. Vision statement, our students will develop work ethics and employment skills to become capable of independent living while sustaining a healthy cultural identity. And once again, that which is in bold are the elements that we focus on. Sustaining a healthy cultural identity really is the fabric of the instruction that we deliver and for student engagement. And I think you'll see that coming in the slides ahead as we move into programming. So structure, running a residential program, a 24/7 program, most of our high school programs, 2 weeks in length, requires a great deal of structure to assure that students make positive choices. So this is a look at the daily schedule. Every day when students wake up in our dormitory, there's a whiteboard that shows what's happening, and it begins effectively at 7 a.m., 7:20 when the breakfast bar closes, until 10:30 at night. So the days are long. It's 15 hours of structure that's within there. It's 15 hours of structure that we find that students, teenagers, may be initially resistant to structure of this sort, but that they come back to because it has an element of safety and comfort for them. So beginning every day after breakfast, we have room inspections that occur. We have morning swimming that occurs from 8 o'clock to 9:15. This is an element that once again came to our advisory board at startup. We had a very high death rate in our region on water. All the villages are located on water, but you know, they're frigid Arctic conditions. They're not the type of water that you learn to swim in. So the city of Nome pool pictures in the lower left is where we begin each day. And if you can think of a day that's 15 hours long, you need that element of activity in the morning to get the endorphins flowing so you're awake and into your day, because it's going to last. And it's an element that we find that is a confidence builder in students. It's an element you don't necessarily need an instructor to tell you how much you're improving. You can feel it day by day as you progress. So every one of the elements where we're stacking successes for students, that they're gaining self-confidence, is helping them gain the assurance in themselves for things like living away from home independently. And we transition from that into an American Red Cross first aid, CPR, or AED, automated electronic defibrillator certification in every high school training program. So every student will go through. If we have returning students that come through, our instructors are always looking to see which certification they can deliver to reach the largest group of students. A student that's returning has a certification will retest. If they retest at an 80% level of proficiency, then they can advance on to perhaps individualized driver education, instruction, a homework time. If they want additional time for that, can be set aside. But the bulk of students are going through that. And then for the next 5 hours, they go into a core training. So on the left-hand side of your packet is our training calendar for the year, and that shows the wide array of training programs that a student will sign up for. I think it says 2016-17 NACTEC training calendar on the top of it. So during that four-hour block, there's a break in the middle for lunchtime and a half-hour downtime. We encourage students just to relax, take a nap as they go into the long second half of the day. As they come out of that block of training at 3:30, they go into career skills and career counseling. And I often say this is the most important hour of the day. This is the hour of the day to take what they've learned in that core vocational training they're in and make the connection between where they're going to go for post-secondary training or entering into the world of work. The picture on the lower right is Vicki Erickson, Employment Security Specialist at the Nome One-Stop Job Center. Every group of students, high school students, we break down into two groups, go to the Nome One-Stop Job Center. They get enrolled in the Alaska Labor Exchange System. They learn how to search for jobs in their home communities and within the region. So we do a wide array of things, resume writing, interviewing, applying for scholarships, applying for school, applying for jobs, all the things to help students make that next transition. And then from there, they return to the NACTEC house in the evening. What's listed as chores is a lot of our life skills and independent living, cooking for themselves, eating together as a meal, cleanup duties that follow. There's evening activities that are planned, once again, that may return to recreation, going to the rec center to play basketball, going on outdoor hikes, swimming, Eskimo dancing, participating in things that are happening within the community. And then you'll see there's homework time belted in the evening. There's a standards checklist. There's a reflection of what they did for the day and why they did it. And then it's 10 o'clock is their quiet room time, and 10:30 is lights out. So that structure follows for the 2 weeks that they're with us. This element right here, the life skills and independent living, this has been identified by our industry partners as perhaps the most important thing that students are getting as they come in and live in the residential setting. The career exploration training, the core vocational training, is important to open their eyes as to what possibilities are there. But in this setting, students are learning the structure. They're learning to live with others. They're learning conflict resolution. The young lady in the lower left corner is in a room making her bed. There's two or three students in every room. We put students from different villages together, so students learn to move outside of their comfort zone of those that they know, as they would most likely going on to schooling elsewhere. The top picture shows students in quiet homework time, and then what that looks like when all the tables are removed and they're cleaning up after a meal is done. We pay $0 in custodial support. It's all part of the life skill trainings that we do. So the facility is continually cleaned and turned over after every training program. The young ladies in the lower right, each of the kids become parents on the weekend from 6 p.m. Friday night to 6 p.m. on Sunday night. We have these reality work baby simulators. So they each name their baby. They get a birth certificate on that baby, and they have to care for that baby through that 48-hour period, learning to recognize when there's a cry that needs a diaper change, that needs a feeding, that needs coddling of some sort. And they're wonderful instructional tools, and that they have fantastic element of data that they provide at the end. Like the Red Cross certification, it gives you a score and an outcome that you must pass. So if you pass your parenting element, when you come back, you don't necessarily have to become a parent again. If you don't, we redo that training again. Some of the students like it. One of the young boys we had this fall passed the course. He came in the second time, and he wanted to see what it would be like to be a parent of twins. So he took on two of the babies. I would not encourage that myself. The students tend to be a little bit sleep-deprived on the weekend, but it does also, at the same time, prevent other poor choices that could be made. So structure is very, very important. Programming. We deliver our training really based around Alaska's priority industries. So the five that are in bold: healthcare, construction, transportation, seafood harvesting and processing, hospitality, tourism, are strands that we have multiple courses. And then education, information technology, and natural resource development are three others that we hit in some form but are without developed strands of instruction. So I'm going to just walk you through those top five and look at student programming and our approach to those. And I'll note to begin with, when NACTEC started up It began by delivering high school training programs. And one thing that was noted by teachers at the sites was that we were too late. We needed to start earlier. That students needed the exposure at the junior high level and as the means of preventing early dropout in high school. I read in the summer of 2015, in Education Week, July 2015, a study, and it said that 60 to 70% of chronically disengaged students are in the 7th and 8th grade. So reading that just confirmed what we were already hearing from teachers at the site, is that we needed to focus at the junior high level to get students to come in for a shorter duration, a one-week training program. So in our junior high programs, which are really focused at the 8th grade level, students come in with a chaperone from site. It kind of provides like a mother hen effect. They have somebody they know, a teacher or a classified staff member, they can fall back. Homesickness is huge. Students come in from very small villages where they know everyone. To be roomed with somebody from a different village is moving them way outside of their comfort zone. So that serves to give them somebody they can fall back to help them successfully transition. So what we do when we bring them in is we expose them to a wide range of jobs that they wouldn't otherwise see in their home communities. So a few of those that are pictured here, the Army Air National Guard is a popular one. Public safety, firefighting at the Nome Airport. On the left, going to either one of the two radio stations, having students interview. Bearing Air on the lower left, exposing students to careers in the aviation industry. On the bottom middle, Casey Miller of UAF Northwest Campus is introducing students to the nursing facilities at the campus. We do hands-on training. On the right-hand side, students are learning hand tools, safety, measurement as they're building dog houses. And then on the bottom right, looks it is a bunch of kids sitting at a table, but it's a lunch and learn sponsored by Norton Sound Health Corporation. They're our largest regional employer, so we bring students in at 8th grade, and they get to talk to people in a wide array of jobs at Norton Sound Health Corporation to prepare them for high school training programs. What we found is that students coming through the junior high programs, and right now we're seeing about 70% of Bering Strait School District and Nome Public Schools 8th graders, they continue on to our high school training programs at a rate 21% above the students that we don't otherwise see. So it's an important conduit to get them in. I have just one slide to show you that on the background of each of these training strands, what we look to do is set up our courses for either dual credit, certification, both, if not, some value-added element that is provided by the training. So in the healthcare strand, we have the Health 122 course in the middle, first aid and CPR, I already noted. That's a foundational course delivered in every high school training program. Health 105, Intro to Health Careers, and Health 110, Professionalism in the Workplace. These are courses that we use that adjuncts for Norton Sound Health Corporation teach for us to help guide students into capstone courses their senior year. The Emergency Trauma Technician Training is a course that leads into a three-week pre-session ETT. It's an intro to health aid training, and the other is a certified nurse aid, a CNA training program. It's a 9-credit training that's immediately upon graduation. So a student will graduate the next week. So these are students that we've reached in eighth grade, gone through that process of exposing them to intro to health courses, and have vetted to find the right students to go into the right training. So on the left is a poster. Teresa Lana was a CNA trainee that we had from ShishRef come through in 2008, completed the training in your packet with a binding on our series of success posters that we have. On her, she effectively attests to how important that training was for her to gain confidence in herself to continue on to post-secondary schooling. So she first moved from ShishRef to Nome to work at Norton Sound Health Corp in the Kiwanis Care Center, caring for the elders of our region, then Nome, and then continued on to the UAA School of Nursing. I should note we have a local health consortium. It meets the third Tuesday of every month. We've met for 14 years to talk about health care in our region. So we have partners from NACTEC, UAF Northwest Campus, Norton Sound Health Corporation, Quirk Inc., and Nome Eskimo Community, the Native Nonprofits, the Northwest AHEC, the Area Health Education Center, that develop the training that we need. So CNA has been a capstone at NACTEC for seniors. That has evolved into an RN program through the UAA School of Nursing. The UAF Northwest Campus works to deliver in Nome. It's supported by Norton Sound Economic Development Corporation. Teresa was a student who went to UAA School of Nursing, and like students from our region, it's not uncommon, miss home, want to come back home. She returned home and came into this local option program. She graduated in 2014 and has been working as an RN at Norton Sound since. So what we're attempting to do is get students interested, career awareness and career exploration in junior high, move them, advance them into career immersion training in high school, and then on to technical training and higher paying jobs along the way. One of the things that we noted as we looked at data with our CNA trainings was that a lot of them were later appearing to be health aides out in the villages. So we approached Norton Sound and said, you know, one of the barriers to becoming a CNA and working in a region is you have to move from the village to Nome, and it's very expensive to live in Nome. So a CNA is barely a living wage in Nome. You need a second job or to live with others to get by. However, health aides are also high in demand in the villages. So we asked if they would partner with us with a combined adult and high school senior training course. And what we found, and the feedback was tremendous. The picture on the left showing the students holding their certifications is from the first class. We had a 71% success rate in the first group of trainees going through. To me, that seemed low at first. We had a 93% success rate in our CNAs. But the trainer noted that in the adult trainees, it's typical to have a 50% attrition rate. And one of the things he noted that was important was that the high school students were at a time where they had not lost that element of math. You graduate from high school, you go on, you don't use it, you lose it, and it makes it more difficult to come back. So we end up stumbled into the sooner that we can bring this training, we're reaching students at a point, you know, where they're prepared for it, and we're having a high success rate. So the young lady on the left, actually pictured in the lower right, on the right, is from Gamble. She was in that first class. She was our first student to go through, become past the pre-session ETT, and this is effectively an apprenticeship-style training program. As a health aide, you progress through community health aide 1, 2, 3, 4, on to a practitioner. On average, it takes about 6 years to reach practitioner level. So you work effectively, say, a year or so, come into Nome for community health aid 1 training, go back and work, come back in a year, community health aid 2. So you go back and forth and you progress through the years. Norton Sound noted that that young lady was one of the fastest to rise up from pre-session to community health aid 1 to community health aid 2. So it's an area that we're hopeful that we can continue to build successes in the future. In the construction training domain, we really flourished between 2010 and 15 when we were part of the Alaska Construction Academies. The funding that supported that allowed us to expand training, wood-based training, welding training, facility maintenance, renewable energy. So the approach that we have is one based on building authentic real-world projects, and we partner with a lot of folks. So in the upper left-hand side, we partnered with the Village of Solomon around the 2014 Iditarod. Anyone that follows, Jeff King was coming in, Ali Zirkel was behind him, and Dallas Seavey was in third, and they were coming down through Solomon, and there were just vicious winds that were blowing, and Jeff King got blown off from the trail, and Ali pulled to the side in safety, and Dallas scooted on by them. Well, that area was noted. It's not just that time of year that occurs. It occurs quite often. There was a need for a safety shelter. So that's a 12 by 16 foot cabin that we built as a safety shelter that's out by Bonanza now. That we had, I think, 8 students that were involved in that. The Village of Solomon bought the materials for it, and we had an authentic project based on a real-world need that had just occurred to engage students. Likewise, in the lower right, the Success Series poster with Sydney Pete in it. Sydney completed training with us. This is around 2010 or 11. And at that time, Kelly Wolf with the Youth Restoration Corps was putting up these safety shelters, these log cabins on the Iditarod Trail. So this is one that went in between Uniclet and Shaktulik. We finished training, connected the student with an employment opportunity, flew out to work on that for 10 to 14 days, got paid, got a tool belt, so learned the skills, the knowledge, and have the tools to take back home to work in the construction industry afterwards. The lower left is a look at Norton Sound Health Corporation, the hospital, as it was going up, I'm guessing around 2011. We take students out to job sites so they can see the job site, know the expectations that are there. Two in the upper right, renewable energy, was a wind for schools program of putting up a 45-foot Skystream wind turbine. So we had our students part of that entire process, building it, doing it, seeing that they can do it and gain confidence in themselves. And then in the upper right, in welding, in your packet, I think there's one. We built a gold mining dredge with a local gold miner. So this is a picture from that. That story is captured within there, as well as the next area, heavy equipment. One of the hallmarks of NACTEC that folks recall or remember going through is this heavy equipment simulator center. So this is located in our student dormitory. Originally, there was a foosball table, ping pong table, air hockey table, couch, and a TV that was set up in this area. So it was a student rec area. Downtime, this is where they went. In 2009-10, I believe it was, in three separate conversations with the superintendent of Nome Public Schools, a board member from Gulvin, who's pictured in the lower left, and the president and CEO of Kwerik, Inc., the native nonprofit, in three conversations that all alluded to we should be doing something with heavy equipment training in our region. We still have high dropout rates. These are well-paying jobs. There's heavy equipment that's everywhere. What can we do? So it wasn't realistic for us to buy equipment, maintain it, and all that goes with it. But I did stumble into seeing at King Career Center in Anchorage, heavy equipment simulator center. It was there with the first iteration of these machines. So through the last 7 years, we've purchased and upgraded, and we've used the State of Alaska Education Tax Credit with partners from Bering Strait Native Corporation, Norton Sound Economic Development Corporation, Pollock Conservation Cooperative Partners, and others, Shell Exploration, ConocoPhillips, have all supported the development of this training center. Those are 8 full motion-based machines. So a student gets on a machine and starts it up, you feel the engine running and it's moving. It doesn't have an engine, but there's electric cylinders, I'm drawing the wrong term, that move, that articulate the machine so that as you're running and you drive over rocks, the whole machine hops and you feel that go over the top of rocks. It's set up so that each of those machines is hooked to a manager station, and we're just beginning to build a digital training portfolio for each student. So if they want to become a heavy equipment operator, they can advance through this training. And one of the great things about it, this shows a student operating a large wheel loader, is that the machine itself walks you through the training. You don't need a teacher standing there telling you what to click on and what to do. And what we found with our 21st century learners is that they're engaged by this sort of technology. Adults may walk in and be intimidated by it. Students take to it. It's friendly to them and what they're interested in. So we use this in the military adage of crawl, walk, run, to crawl through it on the whiteboard, to walk through it on a simulator, and then run through on a real machine. So once again, this is where our partnerships are important. The young lady in the upper left is using a Caterpillar 320C hydraulic excavator. The control she's operating is exactly the same as the two pictures to the right, which is a Cat 320C hydraulic excavator that's just a couple hundred yards behind our student dormitory on a gold mining claim. So we worked with just walking the kids across from our dormitory to that area to have them get an opportunity to use a hydraulic excavator. And one of the things he noted, I inquired of students after they come off from training using that, as to how much more difficult was it to operate, you know, the real machine, and they all said it's easier. The controls are exactly the same, so you know the controls. It moves, so you felt that. But when you move it, you see and experience it in three dimensions, whereas in training, you're looking at a screen and you just see it in two dimensions. So whether it's in gold mining, moving snow that the city of Nome and Nome Public Schools maintenance allowed us to do, or working quality asphalt and paving was redoing the Nome Airport, bringing students over on the D10 dozer. They're learning preventative maintenance, but they're getting on machines and they're getting a little opportunity to explore, do, and gain confidence that they're capable of doing it. Our hospitality and tourism strand, has a native arts business marketing and entrepreneurship focus. This emerged from our local advisory board. We noted our business marketing and entrepreneurship courses had really low enrollment. Students didn't naturally gravitate to those financial elements. However, by infusing a native art, a bone carving, skin sewing, or traditional kayak construction, it was now contextualized in a context they could relate to, and we could infuse the business marketing entrepreneurship. And then culinary arts and food service is the other. In your right-hand packet, there's also, I believe, a 4 or 6 page on traditional kayak construction was put together. We're on our fifth year of delivering this kind of training. Began by building 16-foot Greenland-style kayaks. Malik Padilla is 10-time Greenland kayaking champion, amazing with kids, and I mean amazing with the work he does. So on the left, the kayak they're building, there's no mechanical fasteners. It's all hand lashing with artificial sinew that's there. But once again, we're bringing students, and our attempt is to bring them through an engineering design challenge. There's a design element, there's a fabrication element, and then there's a testing element. So the testing element is in the city of Nome Pool. So while they're building the kayak, in the evenings, Malikik's working with students with dry land training skills, rope training so that they learn how to do rolls in the water, a balance board, all these things so when they get in the kayak, one, they can navigate it, and then some of the more advanced students he was taking and teaching them on shorter how to roll too. Pretty amazing. So we began with that, and that evolved locally to building this past year a King Island style kayak. So in the upper left picture, where Maliki extended behind him in the white, was a King Island style kayak, one of the last that we knew that was built in our region about 30 years ago. So the exposure to it and the skill of people building was being lost through time. So we consulted with an elder in the lower left, Vince Pickawana, an elder from King Island, came in last May and June and worked with a group of students to build the King Island style kayak that you see above the students on the right, the Keturvik Cultural Center. That's the kind of the piece that greets everybody coming in. And our timing was perfect, and unfortunately Vince passed away in December. But before doing so, I had this opportunity of working with students in Malikik to build this kayak and pass along, you know, that history and knowledge to others. We also do skin sewing. The young lady on the left is highlighting gloves she made. We've made baby booties, beaver skin hats. On the upper right, Joe Kunuk, another King Island elder, came in. This was in February, teaching students bone carving ivory in this case. Something to also note that our partners in conversation last week noted to pass along the importance in our region for ivory and any legislation that can protect, you know, for our folks not only harvesting that but using all the parts of the animal. Ivory and fruit is important for them to earn an income. And the lower right is taking students to a retailer in town to show them native arts as well as the process of selling so that we can teach them the skills of the doing, the building, the making, and then the business of marketing so they can sell to maximize profit rather than go through a third party. And then the other course, food service, in that strand. On the left are two pictures. One is a residential setting, food service. So we have a gas range and electric range. This is day one of a training program. Students come in. They go through a State of Alaska food worker card certification. They do all their own meal prep. We have a house parent who's also the cook for Nome Public Schools, comes over, helps students in the evening. When I was in school in junior high, I took home economics. I still remember cooking and sewing that I learned in 7th and 8th grade. We don't have those courses. So that's become family and consumer science since then, but we infuse that into the instruction we have, so it's part of the fabric of what students experience. It's not a separate course, it's what we do. And then we use that to lead them into a food service course. So this is a partnership with Norton Sound Health Corporation. The upper right is Pat Owens. She's the food service manager for Norton Sound Health Corp, and she's also the adjunct for this course. She's with a dozen of our students. And one of the things we really like about this course is that it provides students job shadowing opportunities over at the cafeteria in the hospital. So they do food prep and food service, and they're running the cash register, they're washing dishes, they're doing all of those different jobs, and they're getting networked with our largest regional employer, Norton Sound, at the same time. Our transportation strand, I have transportation and one other strand left, is highlighted by aviation and driver's education. So on the left, the Alaska Airmen's Association helped us purchase a 1962 Piper Colt that we're currently rebuilding in the aviation strand. On the right-hand side, some of our driver ed students, you can look and see behind them. That's the backside of Nome Belts High School. It is 50 years old, but there are three large shops, so that's looking at the back of the wood shop. The lower left, we have, opposite of our heavy equipment simulator center, some boating skills virtual trainers. So everybody's on the water. Living on the water is important, so we have a boater. There's a State of Alaska boater safety certification students can get. So this provides hands-on training for that. The driver's ed program, this we have found to be the gateway to NACTEC. Students will come in for driver's education, and notably, these students are coming from villages where there are no villages, cars, there's no trucks, or there may be one or two. Many of our students haven't been in a car or truck before coming to get in driver's education. So getting them a driver's license, we look at this element along with the swimming. You can see the self-confidence that students gain as they go through this training. But it's important that they have that driver's license, their diploma for graduating, and the driver's license as two prerequisites really for entering the world of work. So in the Nome census area, we're the only game in town doing driver's education. When we're not doing so for students, we're doing so for adults, and that's what's happening in Nome right now. While our students are off on a training program, our driver ed instructor is doing adult training this week. Program evaluation is a huge piece of what we do. We're continually looking at our programs to see what trends are there, and driver's education is one that we noted through the years. We just were never able to stay on top of the demand coming from students. There were always applications waiting for students that wanted to get in driver's ed that we didn't have capacity to serve. So the blue shows in the bottom the permits, the red was the licenses attained. And one of the things that we noticed with trying to get students a driver's license is they would come in from the village, we'd get their skills up, they were with us for 2 weeks. By the time we were confident that they could pass a road test, we would go to try and set them up to get a road test, which is all done electronically these days, and we would find that the four road tests there are per week in Nome were all reserved, and we would have to send the student back home. Skills would deteriorate because they're without training and they have to come back in. So we applied for and became the second, along with Ute and Bethel, a DMV-approved third-party examiner to do road tests. And it showed last year was our first year, FY16, we tripled the amount of students that got a license in the first year. And then FY17 is year-to-date data through last week. We're on pace to double from the previous year the amount of students that are attaining permits and license. And once again, we still are not staying up with the demand that's there. Sitnisock Native Corporation came on, utilizing the education tax credit, become a partner of ours this year so that we could have a full-time driver ed instructor for the first time. And it's showing. The need is there, and we're getting close to reaching demand, but still it's exceeding us. And then the other strand is aviation. The aviation strand, we have what we believe to be one of the preeminent authorities in aviation in Nome. Vic Olson has been involved with aviation since 1957, 60 years. He joined the Air Force as an AMP mechanic, so he has 30,000 hours of flight time. He's retired from commercial flying, but he does all of the inspections on privately owned aircraft in Nome. He comes in and we work 2 to 3 aviation training programs a year. Formerly, we took students up flying. The certified flight instructor that we had that was taking students up, his insurance became cost prohibitive to take students flying. Very engaging, obviously, for students. So we went to focus on rebuilding an aircraft instead. So this is the airframe portion. Students are stripping a wing, beginning to the inspection, rebuilding the ribs on that, and then working on the ailerons to put new fabric on and prime and paint it. And on the power plant portion, Vic's working the upper left to remove the propeller, and then we have students, I love seeing girls with their ponytails that are in turning wrenches, pulling off some bolts that have been on there for 50 years, to pull the engine out, drain the oil, break the crankcase open, and tear it apart to send it out to get rebuilt. And then the hallmark of what we do is when we send that out to get to rebuilt, was have them send it back to us in boxes so the whole engine isn't rebuilt, so that we can rebuild it from ground up. It obviously takes longer, but it instills in students the confidence in themselves that they're capable of doing it. So the Alaska Airmen's Association, Alaska Airlines, and Raven Alaska have supported this strand with financial contributions, and Bering Air and others have come forward so that our students can tour the airlines and get to talk to AMP mechanics. As we were doing this project, we came across a really unique opportunity to expose students to history along the way. The history being Roosevelt's Lend-Lease program during World War II. So during World War II, Russia as an ally to the United States benefited from aircraft such as B-25 bombers that were passed along. So my understanding is they were flown from, I believe, Kansas up through Montana to Fairbanks. The Russian pilots flew through Nome over to Fairbanks to take ownership of them. They painted the red Russian star on them in Fairbanks. They landed in Nome, refueled, continued on to Russia, and were used, you know, to fight against Nazi Germany. This one aircraft, with less than 50 hours on its airframe, we believe suffered mechanical failure coming into Nome and had been sitting there for 70 years. So there was this Warbirds of Glory Museum out of Brighton, Michigan, that were looking to rebuild, the Sambar Mitchell. It was a B-25 bomber of Fairbanks that they had come across, and they were looking at rebuilding this to make it fly again, and they caught wind that there was this plane in Nome. So they contacted us. We worked with them during an aviation program when we were rebuilding that 1962 Piper Colt to have our students help disassemble this 1944 B-25 bomber. So this shows on the left, the bottom, the students and the folks standing on the wing. In the back is a Russian aircraft hangar from World War II that's in Nome. And as they were there working on it, they caught wind through conversation that somewhere out in the tundra was a wing that had the red Russian star on it. And they went searching for this wing and digging through tundra mosses. And on the lower right, that's what you see. After a few days, they found that wing and flipped it and believed it to be the only Russian B-25 bomber still in the United States. So they could barely see the red Russian star. And the ones from Michigan were just jumping and high-fiving our kids. And our kids got excited about it because these people were getting excited about it. But it provided an opportunity to introduce them to the history that was right there in our region that many were otherwise unaware of. So the partnership piece is key across all of our training programs. I believe this is the last training strand to speak of. Seafood harvesting and processing is supported by Norton Sound Seafood Products and Norton Sound Economic Development Corporation, and our Pollock Conservation Cooperative partners too, to introduce students to halibut, crab, salmon. So in the lower left, we do an egg take project on the Snake River in September, where students go out along with Norton Sound Economic Development Corporation's fisheries biologists to capture fish, to get eggs from them, take them back to the lab that you see on the lower right, where students are looking under a microscope and working with the lab technicians on the fertilization process. And in the upper right, Kevin Keith, the fisheries biologist, is working with our students aerating, that's actually Anvil Creek, located just walking distance from a high school. And that's actually where gold was found back in the late 1890s, setting off the gold rush to Nome. So this domain training program includes an Arctic survival strand as well. It has both a water-based element and a land-based. So in addition to swimming in the morning, students are learning personal flotation devices, ice self-rescue, immersion suits, life raft training. And the snow caves, this was just taken in the last 2 weeks. We just finished up that training program last Friday. A week ago today, Wednesday, the bottom right is a freshman and sophomore from Brevig and Teller, Brevig Mission and Teller. As they woke up, it was 11 below last Wednesday morning when they got up. They build a snow shelter and then sleep in it. So it's certainly a survival skill that could be used in our region and for subsistence, but can apply in different areas too. But once again, for getting students to gain confidence in themselves, overcoming, you know, the mental that can be there from sleeping in a snow cave, it's huge for students to go through. and experience that. So this slide shows a program we have occurring this week. Right now, this morning, what time is it? It started about 40 minutes ago. 15 students from Bering Strait School District, Nome Public Schools, and one from the Voyage to Excellence program just began their day in the life of an AvTech student down in Seward. So Alaska's Vocational Technical Center, we take students down there, seniors, some juniors that we have to round up the program, to develop what we call a handhold transitions program, bringing them from MacTech in Nome to AvTech in Seward, and taking all of the fear out of transitioning into a program. So the intent of this program is to have students sleep in the dorms, eat in the cafeteria, ride the bus, enroll in a class, work alongside college students, as our kids say, meet the instructors, complete the TABE test, the test of adult basic education, use the rec center facilities, apply to AvTech, the whole thing. So the three young men pictured here were three that we took down a year ago this week. One from White Mountain, Shishmaref, and Shaktulik that all continued on to AvTech in the fall. Edgar in the upper right completed the construction technology program in January. Siegfried on the left completed the plumbing and heating program in January and then continued on into the construction tech program that Edgar was in. And then Nathan from Shaktulik enrolled in the diesel heavy equipment tech program, a longer program. He's still there. And it's my understanding that Siegfried and Nathan will be speaking with our students that are there this week, later this afternoon, so that they can learn firsthand from somebody who's been there and has succeeded, so that we increase the amount of students that have success at the post-secondary level. One of the things that we found in the past is we were taking students, exposing them on short duration. They get to see it, they come home, but there wasn't a high success rate of kids continuing on enrolling, or if they did enroll, of actually succeeding, and they go a short time and come back home. Nathan is an example also of our heavy equipment training that we built initially with our heavy equipment simulator center that was just for exploration. We built that to have an operator element and then a mechanic element of a student who's continued on in that training with exposure. And I have four slides on data then. And this is a look to show what's happened in our region. So this is looking at the past 13 years of training. So this is the enrollment at NACTEC. And we look at this kind of on a trimester schedule. Each of that trimester is 6 years long. So in the red on the left is the enrollment at NACTEC during the first 6 years, or startup years. Average 241 students. So I looked at data more closely from the Department of Education and Early Development to look at graduation and dropout data to see what was happening back at this time. We know the two school boards came together and there was a need because dropout rates were high, graduation rates were low. But I wanted to see early on what was happening. So those years in red right there, the year preceding 2002-03, Bering Strait School District, which is about 89% of our students, the dropout rate for that year, I believe, was 12.4%. Through these years in red, there were six school districts of the 56 school districts that averaged double-digit dropout rates through those years. So Bering Strait School District was one of those six districts. They averaged 11.3% across those years that are in red. The average of those bottom six districts averaged 13.2% dropout during those years. The next 6 years in blue were enrollment at NACTEC increases to 400. It grew by 66%. The dropout rate during that time, in the most recent years, dropped down to 11.3, down to 4.8%, I believe. And for the districts as a whole, those six districts dropped from 13.2 to 10.3. So the difference was about double the drop for Bering Strait School District from 11.3 down to 4.8, then 13.2 to 10.3 was a 2.9% drop, where it was significant. So we wanted to see what happened during graduation. So the next slide shows, with the same color coding, the BSST graduation rate during that time. So the startup years, the graduation rate, it averages 39.8%, so call it 40% during those years in red. It levels in 2009-10, and then it begins to steadily climb. as more students are exposed to career and technical education training through NACTEC. FY15, it reaches a high of 84%. Notably, that high exceeds the national graduation average, reached an all-time high recently of 82%. So it's the first time exceeding that. Now, as noted by others looking at this, in FY15 and FY16 is also when the high school graduation qualification exam was repealed. So looking at that data, I saw similar across small rural sites, medium, large, and urban schools. The graduation rates do increase during that time. But you can see the trend line that begins in FY10 through FY16 is headed upward. That's a really unique trend that's there. Looked across districts of all different sizes, and specifically in rural Alaska, you see a lot of variability with graduation rates. They tend not to increase steadily or decrease. There's a lot of variability that it bounces up and down. So that stands out as something that's unique. Looked closer at the data to find out that was graduation, here's dropout. What's happening with dropouts? You would expect if graduation rates are going up that obviously dropout rates would be decreasing. So in the blue is 9th through 12th grade dropout, and the red is 12th grade dropout. So as I reviewed this data and looked at it, one of the things I did see in blue was that names would reappear 9th, 10th, and 11th grade, and there was some movement that would occur from folks moving from the village to Nome and back or elsewhere. So not necessarily a true dropout. So the red I looked at is perhaps more indicative of a true dropout that was there. And looking at FY7, 8, 9, we were averaging 38 seniors that were dropping out a year. On the most recent years, 14, 15, and 16, is an average of 9. So I put a numeric value on this. There is a study out of Northeastern University, a 2009 study, that said the cost of a dropout is $292,000. So if you look at that and look and say, well, if we were to accept, 38 students a year that are dropping out back in 7, 8, 9, as opposed to 9 in more recent years, it's a difference of $8.5 million per graduating class. Lifetime earnings that are there, but for each class that's there. So I also looked more closely to see of our dropouts, where were we seeing them, who was coming through NACTEC, who wasn't. And took Department of Education had, I believe it was Perkins data from 2011 to 14 in Alaska, that showed that students that were in career and tech ed concentrators, so two or more courses in a sequence, graduated at a rate 22% higher than students not involved in CTE, career and tech ed instruction. So we looked at our data to see how that compared, and ironically, after looking at a sample size of 1,001 students that dropped out or graduated, what we found was that the influence of students coming through NACTEC was 22% higher. They graduated at a rate 22% higher than the Bering Strait School District population students as a whole. And as we looked closer, we found that 80% of the students that were dropping out, we didn't see a single time in high school. And then we looked to see what were we seeing for students graduating in high school, through junior high and high school programs alike. And over the last 3 years, it's kind of leveled at 84, 83, 82% of the graduates that we have seen coming through. So there's certainly an influence that's there and a population that's dropping out that we know the vast majority of those that we're not seeing. And if anyone has questions, those data slides that are there, I'd be willing to entertain those, whether they're...
We're almost done. Let's hold on to our questions until Mr. Walrath is done with his presentation.
So two slides in closing. Before recommendation, one of the things I wanted to show was just a look at that packet. Once again, it's bound in your packet. Is a look at what we call our NACTEC Success Series posters. Jared was a student from St. Michael that came through. That certainly in high school, he was an outlier. He had his eyes on the prize. He wanted to know what courses were available for dual credit that he could take. He knew he was going to go on to UAF, Community and Technical College in Construction, Trades Technology and Construction Management. So he took all the courses he could, so shorten the time that he was in school. One of our teachers out recruiting last fall went through St. Michael and inquired about him and heard that he had completed his program, was working in the construction trades, and had started a family living in the Fairbanks area. And then one more that I'd like to highlight because it hits into education and it hits into need in rural Alaska, and that's a need of teachers that we have. Gianna is pictured as a student, as a junior down low. She went through a teacher training program, graduated, returned home to the school that she went to, and is now a teacher in Uniplate. And that's a picture of her bringing a group of her 8th grade students through NACTEC last school year coming through. So that's an area that as recruitment occurs, I mean, I look for Bering Strait School District and I saw that they have in the last few weeks sent their staff out to California, Oregon, Washington, Wyoming, Texas, Minnesota, recruiting, you know, to bring folks in. And we do. We have a high turnover rate of teachers that are in our region that if we could find the means of engaging locally and developing locally, we'll have the folks who stay for a long time. And then in closing, recommendations. I've noted through this presentation the Alaska Education Tax Credit has been very important for us. I bet you it represents probably 30 to 33% of our current budget is industry partners that are supporting our training program. Now that's set to sunset in December of 2018, and we would look to hope that would be reauthorized to extend the sunset date on it. Working with our industry partners, I hopefully you can see from the slides that were there the engagement and the realism of what we're doing with students. It's also that they're working on something that's authentic and they can see themselves doing it in the future to continue on. And this is one means to encourage that private public partnership coming together. Another area, the Carl D. Perkins Federal Vocational Funding has been flat funded since 1991. Effectively, it's at 56% of its purchasing power from back in 1991. So perhaps, hopefully, with the call for a whole wide array of national technical-related jobs, whether that's related to roads and bridge infrastructure or pipelines or whatever that might be, we can increase that, not just for Alaska, but throughout the full U.S. And then the last I'll note, any legislating, promoting collaborative approaches, not just between two school districts like Bering Strait School District and Nome Public Schools, but the outreach to occur further, like the Voyage to Excellence program and NACTEC working together. There's a number, you know, of programs that are out there now. The more that we can work together and provide opportunities. Health aid is an ideal training. I believe health aid training only occurs in Nome, Bethlehem, and Anchorage. So if there's areas that can specialize and we can develop a workforce by working together, you know, that's ideal and it's a win-win for all. And I will note in closing that currently we're running at 93% capacity of our junior high and high school programs. Most of our programs are full. We have acceptance occurring right now for our next training program. 50 students applied for the 26 slots that are there. For some of our training programs, we're getting an interest of almost, you know, 2 to 1. And it's difficult when you have to turn students away because, you know, a lot of students are looking for opportunities that, you know, can be transformative of changing their life. So with that, thank you very much. And
thank you.
Open any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Walrath. This was quite incredible. I know I've got hands going up. Representative Johnston.
Two questions. One is, I noticed in your stats that you had a decrease in enrollment in 2016. Was that planned or was?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, no, it wasn't planned. Unfortunately, we lost nearly 30% of our funding, UGF funding, over the 2 years, the year prior and that year leading up. So we ended up having to remove one of our teaching positions, scale it back to a classified position, and remove two training programs. So the amount of training that we're able to deliver is based on funding that's there. So that did drop off. We went to our partners, the local Native corporations, a new one stepped up, and others this year stepped up to help supplement that funding. The two school districts, Nome Public Schools and Bering Strait School District last year, both directed their Perkins funding to come through NACTEC this year for the first time. So that offset about 1/4 of the hit that we took. So You saw exactly what we saw and we were concerned about. It's growing, all of a sudden it drops off. What happens if in that third trimester the trend continues down? So seeing that was huge. That's a drop of 50 students that occurred.
And one more question.
Follow up. Go
ahead. Have you ever considered hunting education? Hunting education, I worked with kids junior high through middle school. I mean, middle school through high school, and I ended up teaching hunting education mainly because either sometimes it was themselves or somebody in their family that had an accident, and it was a great course because it teaches wildlife management, it teaches first aid, it teaches, and I can't shoot the broadside of a barn, but it's a great course.
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, somewhere in NACTEC's archive of pictures online are a bunch of students in orange vests getting out of the back of a school bus with their guns for a gun hunter education course. So yes, we have taught that before, and actually is something that we just discussed of renewing and bringing back. Hasn't been on a strand, but we look at that fitting in that same strand that the Arctic Survival is in with outdoor leadership and guiding. So this upcoming year, we're going to be bringing that back. I was a Idaho gun hunter education instructor. We have an Alaska gun hunter education instructor on staff and looking to get another prepared as well.
Just follow up, I think it's something you could find partners with too. Thank you.
I think there's a rifle range in the basement at West High School.
There is.
And there may be in other high schools. Yeah. Yeah. Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you've shown really stark increases in graduation rate for the students who participate in your programs, and that's pretty cool. Have you done a post-graduation survey to get a similar level of clarity and resolution about the long-term outcomes?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, it's actually one of the things that we're hopeful that our site could do with. I mean, we're open to a longitudinal study to look to see what have been the true impacts for students going through. What are they doing now? How has it changed their life? That question came up, I believe, 2 years ago during legislative session to look and see, you know, the impact of training. So we looked specifically into our CNA training program because it was one of the few training programs that had this industry certification and connected with the industry partner for the purpose of filling CNA positions. This is off the top of my head. I looked at this recently. I believe this is accurate. 2 years ago, we had roughly around 40 students that had completed that CNA training program. We went to Norton Sound Health Corporation's HR department to have them review their records to see locally. They had evidence of 58% of the trainees that have gone through that were either working for them and or involved with scholarships for higher education. Additionally, the records through the University of UAF Northwest Campus showed that 67%, 2 out of 3 trainees, had continued on for additional post-secondary training that was there. So we're aware of some that also moved out of region, and certainly know of others that we saw that were working in different capacities later on that weren't nursing related. But that was the one example that we looked at a specific program to see that. We'd be very interested in having, you know, 14 years worth of data to look and see what the larger impact has been. We see them working around town all the time. We know qualitatively there's something there, but quantitatively we don't have that evidence.
Hello?
Go ahead, Representative Parrish.
That was 50%? 58%?
58%.
Employed by just the regional health corporation?
Yeah, Norton Sound Health Corporation is the largest regional employer.
And you're having to do the research on follow-up on where these former students have ended up. There is no Department of Education is not tracking them. You're doing this personally in your community.
Correct. We have, but that's the element that we would be very open to turning over to someone else, so free of any bias or
there was an effort to create a longitudinal study and develop a database that does follow students from their beginning in the school district in Alaska school system through post-secondary and the work world that was suspended a couple of years ago. I'm very concerned to hear that flat funding, I believe, is what has caused your drop-off in funding and having to lay off instructors and therefore losing the ability to teach more kids, to get more kids in this program. Has your district done any looking at what it will cost them? There are some suggested cuts to education that are frightening to me, coming from the other body, in terms of $69 million to be cut from the base student allocation, which I'm sure will impact, which I'm sure will impact your program. I know, as the director of the NACTEC program, you're probably not involved in the budgeting process at the school district level, but you're going to be impacted by whatever comes down out of this legislature when and if we finally adjourn and come up with a budget.
Well, we certainly did see the impacts from the UGF cuts that were there. The Perkins funding that I noted was flat funded since 1991. To be honest, that was new to us this current school year from both districts. So for us, that offset, an element, but increases to there would certainly be one more area. Our the Native Corporations, mm-hmm. North Sound Economic Development Corporation, they're utilizing the State of Alaska Education Tax Credit mm-hmm. right now to help us, to help leverage some of those cuts we faced last year. With regard to student interest in programming, it is for no lack of student interest. I mean, our enrollment will go up this year, but we have looked, based on those cuts that hit us where we had to eliminate some residential programs, to work at the same time with Nome Public Schools, our local partner, where we can get our staff delivering career and technical education training for their students in a non-residential setting. Mm-hmm. So we're looking and exploring win-win for all partners. So if you get here, what opportunity might this create, for another partner?
So currently, at this reduced UGF funding, your facilities are lying unused part of the year that they've been used in the past?
Chair Drummond, it impacted us last year where the cut was, where we scaled back with Sitnisok Native Corporation coming on to help us fund a full-time driver education position. I know that that's one of the most important programs. Mm-hmm. Our enrollment, has grown there. But there's not a portion of the year right now that we're cut and we're without. We're leveraging. Where these funds get cut, we're going to get funds from elsewhere mm-hmm. to keep training going. Mm-hmm. But it is an extremely time-consuming process mm-hmm. that is nonstop. I looked at NACTEC's funding in the early funding years, and the budget was sustained by an average of 3.5 funding sources. This year, I believe it's 16 different funding sources. So the funding sources are getting smaller, mm-hmm. and the outreach is mm-hmm. further. But frankly, that's what we need to do so that we don't have a drop-off in our student programming.
And so it takes a considerable amount of your time or district administration time to line up these funding sources as they get smaller and multiply in number.
That's correct. From my position mm-hmm. alone of mm-hmm. the sole source of grant writing and financial outreach and partnership efforts, then there's much more time being devoted to that.
And the Alaska Education Tax Credit is critical to continued operation. Thank you for yes. alerting me to the sunset. I will be looking at introducing legislation to make sure that that's extended. As rather than cut, I have knowing that your collection of data is limited to what you have time and ability to look at. What percentage of the students in the Nome City School District and the Bering Sound School District is NACTEC able to reach? You talked about, gave us really good numbers on the dropout rates improving and the graduation rates improving, or the dropout rates dropping and the graduation rates increasing.
The Bering Straits School District, last year's graduating class, we saw 63% of the students in high school training programs alone, 82% across junior high and high school programs.
Okay.
Bering Straits School District.
63% high school and 82% junior high
and or high school.
Okay.
So Bering Straits School District represents, the 15 villages are 89% mm-hmm. of the population we have. So residential programming is the vast majority of the programs we deliver.
And you could have served more students if you had the funding and the instructional capacity.
If you look at the, Chair Drummond, look at the training calendar in the right-hand packet in your folder, it really shows what trainings we offer and where there are trainings that aren't plugged in. You'll see tend to be breaks around holidays, mm-hmm. Thanksgiving, mm-hmm. Christmas, perhaps school districts, professional development in October that are there. So it's a rather packed training calendar that's there. That extends clear into mid-June. There's another training program that doesn't show on there, a new one this year that starts up the week after the last one listed. We're working with Illisavik College on a Northwest AHEC, the Area Health Education Center, on a behavioral health aid camp that's there. So one of the things that's nice about the large residential facility that was built to house 26 students is for energy efficiency, as well as this big, huge blue roof that absorbed the sun's energy quite well, that helps during the wintertime. That during the summertime of July turns it into a sauna inside.
Wow.
So absent of putting fans up, because we won't install air conditioning for 1 month, mm-hmm. the 1 month we don't have that, we're also maintaining the facility. So there's certainly some wiggle room to squeeze a little bit more in there, but it's a very packed training calendar throughout the year.
This leads to more questions. That sauna effect, is that increasing over time? I know you haven't got the time to gather data on students completely, never mind the climate change possibilities. I'll retract that question. Back on the driver training, that was absolutely fascinating that you are the only source of driver training in the area. Can students take the permit tests in their home villages, or do they have to be at the NACTEC facility?
Chair Drummond, you hit on exactly, as we look at programs and see how we can deliver them most efficiently at the least expense, that's exactly what we're trying to do, is set up a network of proctors in the villages so that students can take the permit test mm-hmm. in the village. We're not there yet.
Okay.
Students are flying in. They're passing their permit exam. They can drive on Nome Belt's campus up until they get their permit and go onto the road system, and then they need to wait 6 months, if under 18, to come back for a road test that's there. But that's something that we're hopeful in the next couple of years, is that we can get reliable proctors set in each of the villages. Students can attain their permit from the village, come in, and immediately get behind the wheel to start training.
And I assume, do you work with DMV?
We do, yes. We are a third-party examiner, so mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. we are doing road test examinations when the capacity is exceeded at the DMV. We have a wonderful DMV representative that we work with in Nome.
Great. And so does DMV have a facility in Nome?
There is a DMV
facility. Okay, so you're working in addition to?
And the bottleneck there is noted, there are only 4 road tests a week in Nome. So when those 4 road tests are full,
wow,
that's it.
It's about a half an hour. It's been years since I've taken a road test.
Yeah.
About a half an hour each. Wow. That's incredible. Any further answers? Representative Kopp.
Doug, I really appreciate your presentation. It's inspiring, and I think that you are an example of a model of education that we need more of in Alaska. I like the fact that you're partnering with the private sector, because one of the things that we hear as committee members is there can be a disconnect between what's coming out of school and maybe what's needed for employability, for viability, for the ability to be successful in life. But when you're, when one of your funding sources through the Alaska Education Tax Credit Program makes it possible to fund with the private sector, you all of a sudden are educating for success in that area where those job classes and types are needed. And I think it doesn't escape my attention that I think that's one of the things that our education system as a whole in the state needs to do more. And we see, you know, I know Bristol Bay Borough had something similar with a Save Tech program, or I'm not sure I'm saying that right, but I don't know where that's at now. But I'm glad you're pursuing this model, and I think it is an example of how to succeed and really help Alaska occupy our own land. You know, one of the problems we have is falling back into the cities, but you're literally breathing life into those communities out there by providing wholly educated youth that are immediately ready for success in that culture, job classes that are needed. So thank you, and it's been very illuminating.
Well, through the chair, Representative Papp, if I could note, you did mention SAVEC. So SAVEC is a regional training center. So the series of regional training centers from SAVEC to Ute and Bethel to ANACTEC to Alaska Technical Center in Kotzebue and others that are there are also supported. TVEP funding, Technical and Vocational Education Providers funding, is very essential. Like the Alaska Education Tax Credits you've mentioned with the industry buy-in, it is that element of training for workforce development in Alaska that TVEP provides in a lot of different areas that hopefully you can see, providing CNA training, growing into RN training locally. If we can do it locally, we can do it at a lower cost, and we can develop the folks who will care for others in our region. So TVEP funding as well is critical to that.
Thank you.
I've been to your facility in Nome. Several years ago, I was in Nome on a, I think it was a Penoir economic development site tour, and I've been to Nome a number of other times. Sitnasauk was a client of mine for a few years as a graphic designer. I've seen a lot of what happens in Nome. I've also been to AFTEC, and that was at the invitation of the Department of Labor in my first summer as a legislator, and that was absolutely fascinating. And maybe we can work on tours like that for the education committee in the interim, so that we can get familiar with what our state provides for our students and for our future workers. We have some terrific facilities. Question on the funding of the boarding school. Did Nome and Bering Straits conceive of that idea and fund it yourselves out of local funds? I know that some additional funding was provided in 13-14 and maybe 15 through the Department of Education through a budget addition here through the legislature.
Chair Drummond, so if I understand the question correctly, boarding school costs, there's boarding school stipends, and I think you're right, mm-hmm. around 13 or 14.
Mm-hmm.
NACTEC application was accepted mm-hmm. For boarding school stipends through Department of Education. That offsets the living expenses mm-hmm. For students to come in, stay in the dorms, their meals, house parent supervision, all of those 24/7 type of things that need to occur in a residential mm-hmm. setting. So right now, we effectively have three primary funding sources. One is the boarding school stipends. One is TVEP funding, and one is the education tax credit. The education tax credit merely is a mechanism for us to go out and solicit funding. There's nothing that's there without working to attain, you know, to build partnerships. But it opens that door that's essential at this time. So I had noted to our advisory board in December that when we spoke of the funding mechanisms that were there, that effectively, we were a chair with four legs, those three funding sources and UGF funds that supported us. Mm-hmm. So at the time, we lost the UGF, and Representative Johnston noted the decline in enrollment that occurred there. We went from a chair with four legs to a chair with three legs. And you can still sit on it, mm-hmm. and you can wobble a little bit, but you're okay. But if you chop one more leg off, any one of those three, mm-hmm. the chair is going to come tumbling over. So it's important to note that, you know, all three of those funding sources for us are critically important.
Did the UGF funds disappear entirely?
Correct.
Okay. In what fiscal year was that?
2015? Yes, June 29th last year.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. See, any other questions? I had one, it slipped out of my brain. TVEP. What is TVEP?
TVEP is a technical vocational education providers funding. It's through the Department of Labor. It's via unemployment insurance contributions.
Say that again? The unemployment?
Unemployment insurance contributions.
Really? It comes through unemployment insurance. Wow. I'm running out of space for notes here. I'm going to have to listen to your presentation again and get after you for some additional answers. Thank you so much. I have learned a ton, and I know that my fellow committee members have also learned a ton. And there are other some other facilities similar to yours at the middle school and high school level in the state.
Correct.
Tell us who they are.
I've noted the Voyage to Excellence program. Chugach School District is probably the longest operating. Where we're on year 14. They are probably closing on 20 years. Mm-hmm. The Star of the Northwest program,
right? Northwest, we had a presentation from them.
School District, mm-hmm. in Kotzebue.
Mm-hmm.
XL Alaska is a new startup down with Cuspuck School District. Oh, once you start, then all of a sudden your mind stops right. along the way. I wouldn't want to include any, but I would note that they're all very important. Provide similar type of programs built locally to meet the local needs mm-hmm. that are there. So I would extend an invite to any on this community coming through NOM to certainly check out NACTEC if you have the opportunity. And I'd also like to note that I've really appreciated listening in over this legislative session on the joint education committees that you've had too. There's been some fantastic discussions and
thank you.
Great information.
Thank you. All right. Thank you once again, Mr. Walrath. Really appreciate your taking the time and coming down to educate us. And thank you for all the work you're doing for your students. I can tell they appreciate you from all the smiles. All
right. Thank you.
We don't have an education committee meeting scheduled for Friday, but I do know we're inching closer to the 24-hour rule and bills may start moving faster. So I suggest we all stay posted, and my office will let you know when our next scheduled committee meeting will be. With that, we will adjourn today at 9:51 a.m. Thank you.